Now, I just have to say good morning to Jason. Hello, Jason. Good of you to join us.
Thank you. Good morning.
The great invasion of guests has begun. So Axel is apparently just grabbing coffee and he will be right here to chat with you. So I'll just go to Sir Fella and then we'll have a chat if that's okay. Sir Fella, go ahead.
Morning, Mockers. Woo! To Chris.
Woo!
Woo! Will, what kind of altitude would that plane be flying at? And also, Chris, the owl insignia is, of course, historically linked to the night fighter squadrons of the Second World War.
But probably flying at the 10 to 13,000 feet or 13,000 meter.
Okay, so it's not like, what's that in feet? Stand feet,
30,
Will.
40,000.
30 to 35, yeah.
Something's got to go a long way to hit that, isn't it? It's going to take some
Yeah,
time.
so and that's the thing, right? It's a long way out there and it's a long way up. So
Yeah.
it's a hell of a long shot.
That's a good shot.
Certainly was. Certainly was. Now, good morning, Jason. I know you're a very busy chap, and I must say thank you very much for giving us some time today. I note that there's a lot of important visits happening in Kyiv this morning, and that's great, but is there something in particular that you'll be doing today?
Well, there's a lot going on in Kyiv. That's true. I just saw Zelensky's motorcade go by. He's in front of Mikhalsky's support, it looks like. But anyways, there's a lot going on. The Yes conference is also happening here, and there are hundreds of guests. I mean, it's actually amazing downtown Kyiv how many foreign cars there are right now, and how much police there is. I mean, there's just tons and tons of police here, and it's all for the various signatories who have arrived. And it seems that a lot of it was not pre-announced. A lot of them have arrived, presumably for security reasons, did not make it public before their arrival that they were coming. But the city is now absolutely packed, and that's a good sign. Obviously, that's good that Ukraine's not being forgotten, at least by some. And it's good to see that there is still strong international support from some sectors.
Yes, there certainly is some strong vocal support, and there was again at the meetings that they had yesterday, the OSCEPA meeting, I believe Richard Coles was very vocal about supporting Ukraine, and the fact that the Russian Federation didn't turn up was fun for them as well. They actually had a nice meeting, apparently.
But yeah, apparently. So, it's good to see this all happening. I'm very interested to see what develops next. And we see in recent trips to Europe, even the recent Munich Security Conference, Ukraine was a major issue. Unfortunately, it seems that there is not nearly the level of commitments or guarantees that have been hoped for. There were some, undoubtedly, but not at the level that would have been hoped for. And I think that it's really important to reflect on the fact that the situation in the war is becoming very complicated. And I don't wish to be alarmist by any means, but I think that everybody here reads the news themselves, so it's nothing that you have not heard before. And it does seem to reflect reality, which is that, without the American support, which had been counted on, Ukraine's in the positions it is, having counted on the fact that they'd be able to defend positions or to take back territories with, the steady supply of U.S. aid. And now that that's cut off, it's having a tremendously detrimental effect, and the European assistance as well. So, I mean, it's not just Americans; also European assistance is needed. Right now, Ukraine is facing the dual problems of the lack of modern technologies, which is historically the reason that Ukraine's done so well in the war. Is speaking to the people here who are working in the war, where the thing that's always given them the advantage was technology. There's always two solutions. You can use a lot of people or use technology. So when you have fewer people, as Ukraine does, than Russia, far fewer people, you have to rely on advanced technology that allows you to be more competitive, more efficient, and to not need to have the same numbers as the Russians. And having that technological advantage has made all the difference in this war. And we see how incredibly superior American technologies or European technologies are to what the Russians have. And being able to keep the Russians from getting too close to the line has allowed them to maintain and eject Russia from the places that it took on February 24th, 2022. But without those technologies, they were getting into, you know, a much more complicated situation as it becomes attritional in nature. Then it comes down to the raw quantities of soldiers that are required. And obviously Russia is cares not at all for its soldiers or their well-being, especially those soldiers. It appears that they are recruiting as mercenaries from other countries. CNN had articles saying there's about 15,000 soldiers from Nepal fighting for the Russians. And that's just Nepal. There's tens of thousands more coming from other countries, Africa, Latin America, from all over the place, finding new people to come fight. Whereas Ukraine's, it's volunteers. It's people, mostly volunteers, who wish to be there or conscripted, you know, drafted to the military service. But it's a much higher cost for Ukraine when it loses life than the Russians, who are simply going out and recruiting people from impoverished countries in quite large numbers. So it is complicated. And this is why we need the technology that allows Ukraine to continue to eject Russia and to continue until Russia will finally not be able to continue its current state of war and will be forced to rethink what it's doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm really hoping that today is a bit of a pivotal moment, that, you know, we have noticed a change in the narratives, that, you know, they're no longer as long as it takes. They're now saying as long as it takes, not as long as we can, sort of thing.
It is. And so, it's frustrating to see, because I think everybody here would agree with the statement that, listen, even if tomorrow, one, Russia doesn't want to make a peace deal right now. Let's start with this. So all this crap that you see, like David Sacks writing about making a deal with Russia. Russia doesn't want a deal right now, so it's impossible. So there's only two options. It's either give Ukraine the weapons or allow Ukraine to get eventually overrun. Those are the two options. There's no option for a peace deal with Russia. It's not because Ukraine, even if Ukrainians wanted to, they couldn't. Russia doesn't wish to. So I think that it's unfortunate the West is distracting itself with narratives that are a joke, that are non-existent. I mean, more to the point, though, I think that everybody here would agree more than just that simple fact is that Russia will not honor any commitment or agreement it has. Even if it signed the deal tomorrow with Ukraine and Ukraine gave up sovereignty of its nation, the Russians would undoubtedly violate that one. But two, the war has never been about territory. It's always been about the people. There are people living under Russian occupation. We know all about the murder and rape of civilians that happens in huge quantities, the suppression of religious groups, of minorities, ethnic minorities. And this is what happens when Russia comes to town. So to abandon these people and to abandon tens of thousands of Ukrainian children who are kidnapped and taken to Russia is, I think, unacceptable and unthinkable. But unfortunately, despite the fact that we all know this to be morally correct, there is some in the West that are pushing for this to end, to be done with, totally abandon the people that we've promised that we would help to guarantee their security. And this is a very unfortunate turn of events. So I do hope that this year's anniversary does catch attention in the West, that people do start to remember their commitment to Ukraine.
Well, something Ukraine is very good at is making a big noise at the right sort of time. And I think the action that's happened over the last sort of, 12 hours is certainly attention grabbing.
Sure. You know, I think that ultimately a lot's gone on. Ukraine is good at getting attention. It is good at trying to remind people of what's occurring here. And unfortunately, Americans are, and I keep speaking about Americans because I am one, and I have to be more familiar with the statistics of what's going on there. It's unfortunate that Americans, overwhelmingly, 74%, believe that the war in Ukraine is important to America's strategic interest. Though despite that very strong percent, overwhelming percentage, that understands it's important for America, we have routinely confronted people who are arguing that the investment in Ukraine is too much. Keep in mind, it amounts to about 5% of the total Pentagon budget per year. Total Pentagon budget. This isn't the U.S. budget. It's the Pentagon's budget. So it's just one part of the U.S. government. That's our total support for Ukraine, 5%. We're destroying our historic enemy. Their military is more than 50% degraded. They've lost hundreds of thousands of soldiers. This is a huge benefit to America's national security. And unfortunately, there's still those who are saying we should save the money. It's better used on whatever it is, you know, to build more military bases within the United States, which we don't need. We really don't need. We do need to defend Ukraine, though, because it prevents American soldiers from having to eventually get involved in the war. So those Americans who are opposing support for Ukraine are ultimately opposing supporting America's national security interest, and they're jeopardizing our nation's security for political purposes, which will come to light in November, the presidential elections and the congressional elections. So I really do hope that things do straighten out in the U.S.
Good morning, Jason. And I just wanted to say really quick, I know that those statistics actually that you just referenced are in one of your latest articles with the Kyiv Post about the a Washington Insider poll about U.S. support for Ukraine being strong, correct?
It's funny you say that. Yes, I think it is there as well. Thank you for reading that.
I just put it up in the nest because I know that it is one of your most recent articles, and since you were just quoting the statistics, I thought, you know, let's throw that up there. So
that's funny.
I hope you're having a good day.
Thank you. It's
very sorry funny to interrupt there, Mockers.
No worries. I was just going to say good morning to Axel. Are you caffeinated, Axel?
And a very good morning to you. Hi, Jason.
Hey.
Yes, I still sound a bit weird, but caffeinated not at all yet, Mockers, but I am here. Our people during the night already kept me up, and it was superbly interesting. We had a great program thus far, and now with Jason here and you all there, I'm quite sure we'll do it justice. So everybody, give Jason a big hand, give the team a big hand. This is a big day today, the second anniversary of the full-scale invasion, 10 years into the war. It matters a great deal. And Jason, thank you for laying it out, as you just did, that this is in the best interest of the United States of America as much as its allies in Europe. And I think we'll be talking about it because Moldova, Transnistria, Ukraine, all of them are Europe.
It is. You know, and I was in Chisinau in Moldova last week, actually. And they were actually more relaxed about the situation. Ukrainian news is picking up a lot, and Russian news is more calm about the situation in Transnistria. That being said, Moldova does have presidential elections probably in October or so. And before those elections, it looks like Sandu or another pro-European candidate is likely to win. It's not likely to be one of the pro-Russian parties, and that's a good thing. But Russia doesn't want to have that happen, of course. Russia views that as being starkly opposed to what it wants to see happen in Moldova. And so there is a legitimate concern that they could start to stoke up tensions in Transnistria, the breakoff region, or they could start problems in Moldova itself. And there's other hypotheses that they could, you know, try attack from Ukraine, coming either from the north, that is from Belarus, or the south, which is less probable. But either way, there's different hypotheses of how Russia might try to destabilize the situation to prevent a government that opposes Moscow from coming to power. And it's something to be legitimately concerned by. And the fact that Moldova, of course, is a country that doesn't receive the attention it deserves, but it is a wonderful little nation, it is a European nation. And to imagine that its future is truly in the hands of someone like Putin, who just arbitrarily decides that the country shouldn't exist anymore, should be part of Russia, is pretty shocking. But that's what he did in Ukraine. And I don't know what the logic would be or how somebody would counter the argument that Putin will just continue. He will not stop. He's going to go from one country to the next. I cannot imagine, and I really cannot imagine, what would be the argument to not take Moldova if he wanted it. I mean, it's obviously sovereignty he doesn't care about. There's a question, is it economically worthwhile for him? Okay, that's a legitimate argument. It's the only counter-argument I've heard. But otherwise, if he wished to do it, would he? Yes, of course he would. Because he's seen that the West has not been able to stand up or has chosen not to stand up for Ukraine in the way that initially promised it would. And for Moldova, even less so. It'd be much harder to even muster soldiers. They've only got a couple thousand to begin with. Even sending weapons would do very little to protect the state. So stopping Putin now is something that will protect Moldova, and that is something that does protect Europe and keeps the Russians away.
Yeah, having the second front, quite literally in this case, and yet another stir up. I mean, we've seen the amount of distraction and the amount of despair. Events in Israel have seeded because there a proxy of Iran and a proxy of the axis of evil has decided that it's the right time to attack another democracy. But evidently, Moldova is significantly more feeble by comparison than Israel was. And Tiraspol to Chisinau, that's not far. Sheriff has lots and lots of agents in the country. What do you make of the timing of this supposed speech and, say, congregation one day prior, the 28th and the 29th?
I talked yesterday to people in Moldova who work in the government, and I asked them what is to be made of that. And they said that it's actually sort of funny. They said the Transnistrian side was the most concerned by these announcements in the press because they were not aware of them. And they're worried that something was going to happen now that the Russians were going to make them do something. But as of at least when the story first broke, day before yesterday, there was not a lot of news about this within Transnistria. I mean, the Transnistrians had not begun actively planning this. So what will actually transpire? Who knows? It is, I mean, listen, it's well within the realm of reason that this would occur, but it's not guaranteed. There's still a good chance that nothing could happen in Moldova. But we'll know this in the next day or two.
So an information operation which has been coming up rather than, a reasonable and in self-determination, as then we might be presented with in the media, that this is an effort of self-determination of the people of Transnistria to save themselves and be, you know, joining Greater Russia.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think that there is, when it comes to joining Greater Russia, there's clearly not a lot of interest. The people of Transnistria have been yes, it is a fake regime. It's not a real government. But Transnistria is such a strange little place. I mean, I've been there a few times, which is surprising because I'm not able to enter Russia or to Belarus and several other countries. But I'm not on the block list for Transnistria, at least the last time, which was truly surprising. But anyways, the reason was simple. I mean, I entered the breakout region, and I said I wanted to go by cognac because it's known to be very good from there and very cheap. And they let me in. They gave me a little pass, a little piece of paper for my passport that said to leave their occupied territory within, I think it was 8 hours. And drove around, looked at it, and left. But the people who actually run the country, the so-called country, it's not a real country, obviously, they are, as you point out, Sharif. It's just a huge monopoly. It's organized crime. It's evolved in tons of different money laundering operations, tons of different things that are what's this called? The illegal supply of things to other countries. They're a weird little place, and they themselves, though many of them, also hold Moldovan passports or Romanian passports. And what makes it very funny is they have an interest themselves in not really seeing the situation destabilized, because even though they are involved in crime as a profession, there's stability in that. They know every month, you know, where do they want to sell things to, how much they need to steal. It's very organized. Now, if Russia comes to town and decides it really wants to change the dynamic and make Transnistria an actual part of the Russian Federation, this is something that they don't really like, because that could mean changes, and that could mean they lose their place. That could mean that Russian oligarchs come and they start to control what happens. So the actual Transnistrians, though they are Putin talking pieces on a personal level, have no gain in this. They do not wish to see themselves become part of Russia. And that's according to people that I've known, Moldovans actually, from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the other government agencies who work on the Transnistria issue, who go to negotiate with them. Because there is negotiation. There are issues that come up between the two territories that need to be discussed. And they've said, no, the Transnistrians themselves, they don't want to join Russia. That's totally not what they want. They like the fact that they're a forgotten, beaten down little strip of land that they can do whatever they want and nobody stops them and they have tons of money. But if Russia comes to town, they could lose that. And that in no way helps them. They don't wish to see that happen. So if Russia does decide that it's going to do something with Transnistria in the coming days, I think that that would, obviously it's a very bad sign, but I think it would be very interesting to see what transpires within Transnistria itself and how much of its leadership might flee.
It's so funny that you highlighted, Jason, that essentially the the sheriff in town, that they have to make sure that their racket is not disturbed in order to...
The great irony. Yes, it is the great irony. The sheriff is engaged in racketeering. And yes, it is actually sort of extraordinary. But this is the reality of Transnistria. Transnistria is, trust me, it's a very odd little place, little part of Moldova, but it is, I think once you understand the dynamics of why it exists and in real terms of why it exists today, it's a money laundering operation. It's obvious. I mean, it's a crime. Everything that they're trying to do, as I told you, alcohol is very cheap. Well, they produce, you know, knockoff alcohol there as well, which they sell to Europeans and obviously in Moldova as well. And there's entire, let's call it the entire professional class to which it exists in Transnistria is dedicated to some sort of criminal activities, which is how Russia always operates. Keep in mind, Russia always operates with criminals, whether it's regimes that are sanctioned, such as Lukashenko's, or in Venezuela, or Nicaragua, or in, name the country, North Korea. Why do they work with nations that are sanctioned? For the same reason they work with people who are sanctioned, such as criminals, terrorist organizations like Hamas. Why? Why are they allies? Because they're all limited from the international community. They're all kept from being able to do normal trade. As a result of that, they're forced to do trade with each other and make deals with each other, because that's their total market of whom they can work with in this world. And so I think in the case of Transnistria, it's, their local partners on a very small level in the grand scheme of things, engaged in illegal trade.
Now, nevertheless, what do you think we should do if we, in the West aren't there, we are looking at this. Assume just for a brief moment that the provocation which Putin likes to place, that this little insertion of more of a, say, opening up the festering wound, which Transnistria is already, using it now, what should we do in the West rather than wait? Let's predicate this. Rather than wait for a little while longer, should we just act? And if so, how?
You know, I honest to God, I think that it's... So, there's a background to this which is important to know. Moldovan and Ukrainian relations are historically very complicated. They were not great. And it's really, I would say it's, I agree more with the Moldovan side of this story for a specific reason. Back years and years and years and years ago, well before 2014, the Moldovans did push to try to figure out the Transnistria issue. And the Ukrainian side sort of dragged its feet because it wasn't a priority. And there's other things to worry about. And they really put as much force into it. The Moldovan side was always worried about it because it's little Moldova. So long story short of whatever happened is that today we're in a situation that the Ukrainians have requested, it appears they've requested, of the Moldovans to be able to go in and to force out the Russian troops that are there and to liberate Transnistria so that Moldova can have it back. It appears that the West has not been supportive of that. I mean, it does open the potential for a two-front war for Ukraine. That being said, it's very improbable because there's so few Russian soldiers in Transnistria. But if we were to take that off the map, we knew that Transnistria was not going to be a threat anymore to either Moldova or to Ukraine, it's strategically wise. And so I guess the best thing we could hope for, actually, is that the West puts pressure on the current government of Moldova to allow that area to be liberated. I mean, literally, it's... The number of Russian soldiers there is in the hundreds. It would not be difficult. They have very outdated equipment. They're totally understaffed, untrained, and they've just been sitting there for a very long time. So if they were to get pressure, those Ukrainians were to really force them out, this would take this problem off the map for forever. And it would also be good for Moldova, at least, because it would open, I think, a much better path forward to join the European Union, as it would then no longer have open conflict within its territory.
Which begs the question, and again, that you described the opportunity and the necessity, actually, but are we ready? Are the French with their special forces, are the Romanians ready to, if and when called upon, to assist, to make sure that if that situation bubbles over or the Russians try to exploit it, what do you think we're going to do? Now, specifically, are we going to say, fine, all right, we send aid? Moldova, for example, uses the same article, sees that it is being attacked by an outside force within and requests assistance. Will we assist?
Well, you know, the problem that we face, though, is well, one, the Ukrainians can do it themselves to liberate Transnistria. They don't need anything from the foreigners. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, there's very few Russians in Transnistria. It would not be complicated. The question, I think, is not that. The question is, how would Russia react to that? I mean, Russia, especially if it does recognize this as part of its territory in the coming days, would not react well. What could they do? It's a different question, but they would not be happy, obviously. And it would also split Russian resources, which is probably a good thing for us, because then Russia would have to, you know, also be concerned with Transnistria. But how it would all play out is a question. I think what the West worries about, what the White House worries about, is the unpredictability. Okay, so we do this. What will Putin do in response? And I think that's been a huge mistake of the whole war, is to always wonder, and what will Putin do then? You know, I think it's sort of irrelevant what Putin would do then. It's not his territory.
The passivity in which we constantly are.
Yes.
What could possibly happen? How can we keep things somewhat on an even keel? And gosh, we are being disturbed because we had a completely different thing in our minds. We wanted to run a different presidency. Why are they disturbing us?
Exactly. No, really, I agree with you. That's totally the way it is. And it drives me nuts because this is the reality. I mean, you know, the Ukrainians also didn't really want to get invaded. This is just what happens when Russia acts the way it does. And for the West to have this sort of naive, or I would say even stupid at this point, after so much time, belief amongst many people that Putin, well, it's just because of whatever reason, Putin just wants those territories, then everything will go back to normal. There is no going back to normal. The guy has launched the largest land war in Europe since World War II. There is hundreds of thousands of deaths. Hundreds of thousands of Russian deaths as well. There is huge, huge losses. Europe is not going to be the same. And we have to understand that this is not stopping here. His plans have been very clear about the Baltic states and Poland. We know what China's plans are for Taiwan. We know what's happening with Hamas and Israel. We know what Iran's role in all that is. But we also know what Iran's role is with Russia. We know what the role of North Korea is with Russia. We know what the Chinese are doing with Russia. So all these global conflicts do tie together. They're not isolated incidences, which unfortunately I think the press usually tries to make this the Transnistria issue or the Donbass issue, Crimea or Taiwan issue. And it's not. They're all interrelated. They're all interrelated. So to look at each one on the micro level and not look at the macro level of why is this happening globally across so much territory, it's because there's this alliance of essentially non-democratic totalitarian states that are against the current construction of the world, that is the world marketplace, the world's international laws and norms, and they viewed it in their interest to destabilize that, and they're actively working to do so.
I think our Romanian colleague Anna has a point on this one.
Hi, hello. So I wanted to point out two things because you mentioned Moldova being reluctant, right? And up until now, never giving a green light to Ukraine to clean out that area, right? They don't have the troops right now. They don't have the money to raise an army in order to take the Russians out from Transnistria. And it is a stagnating wound, as you see, as you said. However, it does not evolve. So for them, it's not a major threat as a country. So that is one aspect of the problem. And they are kind of waiting to see what happens between Ukraine and Russia. And one reason, so it's not an urgency for them, right? As you said, the Russian in Transnistria are not trained. They don't have much weapons. They are not a threat, even if Moldova is not a big country. But you asked yourself, why aren't they willing to let Ukraine, you know, clean this up? And the reason is they don't trust Ukraine. And the reason they don't trust Ukraine is because they witnessed in the past 30 years, Romania had a territorial dispute, with Ukraine. And we ended up fighting in court at The Hague for the Snake Island. Romania lost Snake Island, but Moldavians didn't forget, right? They witnessed this. And Snake Island, it's not much, right? So, and we still fought over it. So one of their fears is that Ukraine will enter, right? They will clear everything up. They will set up troops there and not leave. So this is one of the, and Ukraine is a much bigger power and it's closer to them. So they are willing to keep a stagnating wound, which they have a chance to clear themselves up later in the game, than letting someone else on your territory willingly, knowing there is a good chance you lose that territory altogether because it will be, you know, how do you say, annexed at some point. So that's their fear. This is the history. And this is the reason they don't do anything about this, right? Does it make sense what I'm saying?
No, as I said, there's a complication in the bilateral relations with multilateral actions, case of Ukraine and with Moldova, but you're also right with Romania. And yeah, I don't disagree. As I said, it's a complicated background story to it all. But at the same time, today in the present state, Moldova has few options. I mean, Moldova, I think, is very well aware of the fact. Now, it is being guaranteed its security, its singular hope for security and protection is Romania, obviously, as Sandu has made very clear. She said she expressed that in her calls with Romanian leadership. And that's not surprising. That being said, at the same time, the current threat that is arising from Transnistria, if it is recognized as part of the Russian Federation, is a much more present threat. I understand their concerns and understand the historic reasons for it. But in today's situation, the future of Moldova, I think, is really at risk. And that could come of one of two ways. I think in the short term, what is the concern is what Russia will do after it recognizes Transnistria, if it were to do so. And the second thing that it worries about is, God forbid, you know, Ukraine were to lose this other part of the country, such as Odessa, which was the initial plan of Putin, as we all remember. That was the goal. Fortunately, that did not happen. But had that happened, as a hypothetical, had that happened, I think it's quite reasonable to assume that Putin would not have stopped at the Moldovan border, but would have just swallowed up that state as well.
Yes, 100%.
And as we are in agreement on this matter, at the same time, of course, the current government in Moldova, I think, appreciates and knows and has already heard, and I think has been told very clearly by President Zelensky, that if they need assistance, Ukraine will assist, but not in order to annex, because they should have allayed these, say, primordial and, say, previously created fears out of the long-standing relationship. I don't think that just because, say, agitators of Sheriff and the likes, and also at the far right in Romania, have said that Ukraine will snap up Rybnica, and because they have lost Mariupol. That can't be true. I mean, this is just, there's a certain level of insanity in projecting these kind of takeovers. The people who have the same kind of simplicity in mind that Lavrov constantly displays probably can follow that. But other than that, there is no logic and no rhyme, no reason to it. Ukraine has no benefit from holding on to territory and to assets, which are not itself. I mean, I think that so much should be evident by now.
Absolutely. And I agree with you totally. And, you know, Ukraine's never, as far as I recall, it's never in its history claimed Tiraspol, or I should say territories of the so-called Transnistrian state. They've never once said that it's Ukrainian or that they wish to take it. And it's never been something that Ukraine's pushed for. Now, let's be fair. I mean, Transnistria is incredibly impoverished. There's nothing there. I mean, it's a territory of criminals. So if you were to take it, hypothetically, you're inheriting a lot of problems. I mean, a totally broken infrastructure, a very backwards education system is a total mess. And it's interesting because in the Soviet period, it wasn't that way. It's actually a lot of very intellectual people came from that region. But unfortunately, it's become crushed through these 30 years of being a fake country controlled by Moscow. run by a bunch of criminals, contrabandists, and these sorts of people. So what will happen next to Transnistria is a unknown. But I think that, you know, let's be frank, it's Moldova, which is already itself quite impoverished. The cost of having to administer Transnistria is something that would be complicated for them. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It would be a huge new expense for them to have to cover.
All right. I think Anna has a follow-up, and then I would, if everybody else agrees, I would like to switch gears a little bit to Kyiv right after. But Anna, please.
Very short comment. The current political situation in Moldova, as you said, is not great. The problem is, and I would like to draw attention, everyone's attention. As you mentioned, Moldova is somehow dependent and looking for Romania, right? But right now in Romania, we are closing on elections as well. And the things don't look up. We also have a party which is sponsored by the Russians, which is very vocal. And they didn't tip that point in, how do you say, ticking people off and dropping numbers. They are growing numbers. So I am well aware and trusting that Ukraine will not attack Tiraspol without a proper approval from Moldova. And they don't have anything to, they just want to clear that up. It's like a, you know, a pus, something bad that they need to clear up at their border. But I think everyone in the region is aware of the fact that we are not heading into the right direction. You have Hungary, which is right now pro-Russia. You have Slovakia right now, which is not great. And you have Moldova heading elections not in the right direction. You have Romania, which is right now not in the right direction. So playing the waiting game might be one of the aspects for which we might lose later in the game. I don't know if this makes sense. So in some sort of way, sorting this out right now will mean more pointing fingers that Ukraine is bad, right? More fuss at the international level that Ukraine is bad, and they attack Russia there, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. If it's quick and fast, and they go in, clear it, and go out, and it's like a one-month deal, then, yes, Ukraine can say, you know, we just helped them, we are out, goodbye. And that would be a good thing, right, for Moldova, for the region, for everyone else. But it has to... you have to have trust and rapport for that. Does it make sense?
I mean, I think it's quite obvious the Ukrainian side is not going to invade Moldovan territory, that is Transnistria, and wipe out the Russians without the consent of Moldova. I mean, it is a sovereign country that is occupied territory. It is not Russian territory, and it's not recognized by Ukraine or anyone else really. So that's why they would never just go in and invade this little strip of land that is undoubtedly Moldovan territory, and Ukraine wouldn't invade Moldova.
Yes, no, you didn't catch my point. So what I was saying is that due to the current situation, political situation, if this isn't fast, It's not about going well. It's about being fast, right? This can, you already have in US.
It can be exploited. Under you mean it can be more easily exploited. All right. Okay. Well, from an information warfare perspective, I get your point. I get your drift. I think, Jason, that's always the risk, but brings us back to the passivity. If we fear, then the fear itself is the issue. At the moment, if something has to happen, people will have to act quickly in order to deter it, to close that wound, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I agree. I mean, I think that ultimately there's fears of many things, but we have to look at the problems that are directly in front of us today. And the problems that we have in front of us today, most particular for the future of Moldova, is the fact that the Russians are going to eventually try to destroy that country unless they're stopped in Ukraine. And so at this point, I think that it would make sense for Moldova to be supportive of Ukraine's efforts to wipe out the Russian soldiers that are located there.
All righty. I can see that our friend Decoding is back. Good morning, Decoding. Fitting on this anniversary. Do you have one on Transnistria? Can we move over to Kyiv already, Decoding?
Hi. I know you want to move on, so I'll just be quick. First, as has been intimated, the position in international law was clear. Moldova's rightful government can invite Ukraine in or any other force to assist its liberation of its occupied territory. Two, as Jason said, and as someone who spent 7 years in eastern Ukraine talking to Ukrainian leaders every single day, I can tell you 100% certainty there is no appetite to occupy any part of Moldova. Three, I expect there would be a proper peacekeeping force established under the auspices either of the United Nations or the European Union or an ad hoc group of allied countries from the near territory who would immediately take over from Ukraine's forces, which would withdraw. That would be the way it would play out. For the informational warfare aspect, yes, it's important, but obviously Russia's entire troll since 1991 is that its occupying forces are so-called peacekeepers. We can turn this on its head, and it's an open goal, because they would actually be peacekeepers. Or some other moniker attached to them. Five, the breach of Russia's reputation, its self-image of Ukraine going in, clearing out these 1,500 soldiers, hopefully capturing them from their empty warehouse, ammunition warehouse in occupied Moldova, would be enormous. So the magnification of its significance, obviously Moldova is relatively insignificant in global terms. However, when Russia is cleared out of there, that would be a massive informational warfare bomb in favor of Ukraine, in favor of Moldova, the European Union, NATO, and everyone else. And six, I would say, I used to think that a lot of the former CIS countries or former Soviet countries were waiting until the outcome in Ukraine was clear before making their moves. I now, looking around the former Soviet Union, I believe now is the time to make the moves because Russia is completely distracted. It's maxing out at the moment. And now would be the time to make this move and really complicate the informational warfare environment. And then I'll just finish on this point, which is there's zero chance Ukraine would in any way prejudice its Western, its NATO or European Union alignment by occupying Moldova for anything longer than 2 to 3 days. That's why we would see Bulgaria, Romania, and perhaps Portugal, as we know from our friend Nuno Felix, I think that Portuguese special forces have been training the Moldovan troops, army, to prepare for this operation. So, I'll just leave it at that. I know you want to move on. Slava Ukraine, and thank you all for being here for the past 2 years and for all of your hard work. Out.
Thank you very much, Decoding. All righty, so we'll put a little bow on it. Jason, when we spoke in the past days, you highlighted that in the run-up to the anniversary, you sensed a change of mood in people. And whilst this is just obviously temporary, and it's a reaction, of course, of civil society also to the events in Avdiivka, but at the same time, General McRyan had highlighted a few weeks ago and reiterated this during the night here, that on the one hand, Ukraine has developed this national resilience has showcased this in the last 2 years, but it needs to continuously renew it and make sure that it doesn't lose it. Where do we stand? You're on site, you can feel it, you can sense it in your discussions. Where does Ukrainian civil society currently stand? How is its mood on this second anniversary of the full-scale invasion? Jason?
He's talking into a muted mic about...
Sorry about that. Yes, it's on mute. I apologize. So in short, I think it was different phases. So at the very beginning, there was shock. It was truly unexpected by most people. There was their feeling that of desperation. Within a short period of time, though, I think that switched to much greater optimism. The fact is that Ukraine, as you recall, was able to successfully stop the Russians from reaching Kiev, downtown Kiev, and to successfully start repelling the Russians within a few days of the start of the full-scale invasion. And so there's this optimism that came. And it moved to this whole period of, you know, Ukraine will take back its 1991 borders. We're not just going to repel them now. We're going to go all the way to 1991 borders, and we are going to liberate all the territory. The West was extremely excited back then. At the same time, as you recall, huge public support for Ukraine across Western capitals. Then it moved, I think, to a different phase where it became the realization this would not be fast. Initially, everyone thought it would be really just a few weeks. It became very clear that was not the case, and it continues today. And today, I think the situation has changed, where it's gone from, I mean, I wouldn't say that people aren't optimistic. I would say that it's more realistic that there are high costs to this. This is not something that's just, you know, magically, in the course of 2 weeks, we're going to liberate all territories, the Russians are going to go back, and they're going to pay restitution. No, it's going to be a long process, a very sobering realization of this. I think increasingly when you speak to people, at this point, I mean, everybody knows people have died in the war. Initially, of course, very few people knew someone who died in the war. Now, just by numbers, many, many more people do. So it's a much more, I wouldn't say grim, I'm trying to look for the word for it, much more, I think, realistic understanding of what's going to come next, that it will not be likely quick. It will be painful. It'll be expensive. Expensive not just in financial resources, but to the nation as a whole. And it's something that will have even more sacrifices than have already happened. So I would say it's a lot less excited than before. Before, there was a feeling of just truly unfettered optimism that this was going to be over very quickly and it's going to be a huge success. And now it's a realization that the only way to achieve this success is through significant sacrifice, which will not lessen in the near term.
When you said it's more realistic, have the young people and we should never actually ridicule this, because people should go back to the examples of the first two world wars, and especially in the Second World War, because they can associate more with the images and also the stories they read about the people in the times. People were still dancing, nevertheless, despite the Blitz. People were still living their lives when London and southern England was bombed by the Nazis. People were still trying and having to live. It's important. It's one key element that civil society keeps living and keeps everything together. But at the same time, people in Lviv have been at times now relatively secure, at times, and Kiev has been bombed, of course, it has been significantly more attacked, but especially Western Ukraine has not suffered directly. It has suffered by the absence of loved ones who have fought, who have volunteered, who have died, or have come back maimed and without limbs. How do you see this? Is there now the logical understanding as well as the visceral understanding that mobilization has to generate substantially larger force amongst the younger ones?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's in no country in the world do people get very excited when there's mobilization. Because let's be honest, it's against your will. that you have to go to the military. Now, I think that most people in Ukraine, and the experience I've had in Ukraine for people that get mobilized, is, you know, they're planning something else in their life and they get mobilized, but they realize it's something that's necessary to happen. It's something that I might not have preferred, but I understand it's also my responsibility to take care of. And and if you look at the numbers, there's not a huge problem with people trying to avoid. There is, I mean, obviously problems like every country of people trying to avoid military service. That's not new to Ukraine. That being said, it's not in numbers that are shocking. I think that Ukrainians have accepted the role that they must play to liberate their nation. but I think it's also, obviously, I think for a lot of people, you know, who the war was sort of further away, it's getting closer and closer because it's going to affect, you know, even if I am a grandmother who owns a little store selling candy, the people that are working there are probably going to be young people, and their lives are being directly affected by the war probably much more directly than others. Because either they're going to be drafted or their husbands are going to be drafted or their boyfriends are going to be drafted. And it's something that they feel. And so there has to be backup plans. And businesses here, companies here, have plans what to do if this guy gets drafted or if that guy gets drafted. Because we have to have a backup plan. If he's no longer available for work, you know, what do we do now? So there's a very pragmatic angle to this. Just because, you know, things have to continue happening. Life has to continue going. People need to pay taxes. The way they pay taxes, by businesses working. So all this is affected by what happens next in the war.
All righty. What will you be doing then today on this? We had the debate in the background about commemoration and the commemorative character of the day, but also then the anniversary, because we should be clear about this. In the very first 24 hours, Ukrainian forces stymied the Russian approach to Hostomel and threw them back and defeated them within 48 hours. So you could say that there's also a real anniversary element in Ukraine rising to the challenge.
Most certainly. I think, you know, today there's a lot going on. I mean, I literally saw running through a downtown area, people running, it looks like a marathon or something with Ukrainian flags on. There's a conference here. There's foreign leaders, lots of foreign leaders now in Kyiv. I myself in 15 minutes, I'm speaking at a forum hosted by Garry Kasparov about the fact that Russia is posing a threat to global security. This could be the beginning of World War III, and this is why we have to stop Putin now. We cannot allow him to continue in Ukraine. Ukraine's victory is the absolute best thing that can happen to guarantee global security. And aside from that, I have some other TV here in Ukraine, different TV shows to attend. But yeah, it's an important day. It's a very sobering day. I think that's something that's different now, is that you really feel that it's the cold, hard truth that this is going to be painful but necessary. And in the end, it's the best thing that can be done for the security of the West.
So then please pass our best regards to Garry and ask him why on earth he hasn't joined us yet.
I can ask him, it's not a problem. But so I actually have to jump offline because I have to get my video camera ready for this this thing with him. So I have to run. But I appreciate y'all tuning in for 2 years and everything that Maria has done to bring the global attention to Ukraine. It's obviously greatly appreciated, a great service to Ukraine. And we'll continue fighting till victory.
Till victory. Absolutely. Thank you very much. Everybody, please give a big hand to friend of Ukraine and an absolute patriot, Jason J. Smart.